While I was in divinity school, the Harvard Unitarian Universalist Ministry for Students, HUMS, we called ourselves, in order to raise money for our student group, did UU walking history tours for coming-of-age groups and others who were in the Boston area for UU pilgrimage of some sort. We did two tours, one of the Harvard campus itself, and then one in downtown Boston. We started at 25 Beacon Street, and then stopped at other points of interest and related bits of Unitarian and Universalist history. These walking tours have a long history in the HUMS community, and the information in the tours is constantly being updated to include people and events whose voices or presence had been left out of much of standard UU history. History is important, and how it is told and whose voices are included is also important. This weekend marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first African slaves in English North America. They arrived at Fort Monroe in Hampton, Virginia. There is a huge commemoration going on there this weekend. The New York Times marked the event by initiating the 1619 Project. The culmination of the project appeared in the New York Times last weekend in a special magazine section. Interspersed with a timeline of African American history is a series of essays, poetry, and art by mostly African American writers and artists that respond to the different moments in the history. The essays, in particular, look at the legacy of slavery in terms of its repercussions to the present day. They address issues as diverse as economics, healthcare, and traffic patterns. The first essay by Nicole Hannah Jones, The Idea of America, acts as an introductory essay and makes the point, our founding ideals of liberty and equality were false when they were written. Black Americans fought to make them true. One of the pieces in the 1619 Project is an art project. It is a redacted copy of the first Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, written and signed by George Washington. One of my concentrations in graduate school was peace studies. My professor, Diane Moore, who taught many of these courses at the Div School, always started her classes by handing us a paper by peace theorist Johann Galtung called Cultural Violence. In this paper, Galtung defines three kinds of violence: direct, structural, and cultural. Direct violence is what we think of when we think of killing, maiming, direct threats of physical violence. Structural violence are those laws and norms that prevent certain individuals or groups from thriving in society. And cultural violence that Galtung introduces in the paper are those cultural ideas, explicit or implicit, that some people are subhuman, are of a lesser species, are incapable of governing themselves, that legitimate forms of direct or structural violence. Chattel slavery in the United States combined all these forms in an intertwined system of violence that was almost impossible to disentangle even after slavery was made illegal. And indeed, it has yet to fully be disentangled. What love looks like in public is when we as individuals or as community struggle to pull apart those threads and create a more just and less violent society. We UUs have a very mixed history in this call to side with love. In our walking tour of Boston, we both point out those who sided with love and those who, in order to maintain the status quo, did not. One of our first stops on the tour is the State House, a huge building with a gold dome that sits on the edge of Boston Common. It can be seen from quite far away. The building was designed by Unitarian Charles Bulfinch in the 1790s and has two statues adorning the front. One of those statues is of Daniel Webster, a Unitarian. Although anti-slavery was one of the crafters of the Compromise of 1850, which included the Fugitive Slave Act, which mandated that all slaves, even those who made it to the North, must be returned to their owners in the South. There was a $1,000 fine imposed on those harboring runaway slaves in the North. Even freedmen could be captured and returned to slavery and had no recourse or defense if they could not prove their status. Webster's defense was that his compromise staved off the war for another decade. But others said that it simply stirred and heightened tensions between conflicting sides. For Webster, it was easier to defend the status quo. Charles Sumner, whose statue appears in Boston Public Garden, opposed the Compromise of 1850 and fought for the protection of and full rights for freedmen. He was so severely beaten on the Senate floor by South Carolina Representative Preston Brooks that he was never able to work again. Abolitionists, particularly those who advocated for an abrupt end to slavery rather than the gradual phasing out, were vilified in their own time. One of the most famous of our Unitarian abolitionist forebears, Theodore Parker, though quite famous now, was shunned as being both theologically heretical, even by his Unitarian circles, and too radical in his views of abolition. He was said to sit at his desk with a pen in one hand writing sermons and his pistol in the other hand protecting fugitive slaves that he had hidden. His words, "The arc of the universe is long but bends toward justice," are often attributed to Martin Luther King Jr. Theodore Parker sided with love in that he refused to compromise, and he was not just resisting those who were his enemies. He was vilified by colleagues and friends who may have shared his abolitionist leanings but could not side with him in his radical ways. He died in exile in Italy before the start of the Civil War. As the tour progressed, we stop at the statue of a woman, the only one who graces the front of the Boston State House, Mary Dyer. Mary Dyer is not a Unitarian, but we use that statue as a springboard to talk about women who also played a role in siding with love. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper was a Unitarian, also an abolitionist, who showed that white men in Boston were not the only ones active in abolition in the 19th century. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper was a free African-American born in Baltimore. She was an abolitionist who served before the Civil War as a traveling lecturer for the American Anti-Slavery Society and was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. She and her family had to flee Baltimore after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act for fear that they might be sent south into slavery. She sat with Mary Brown, the wife of John Brown, who had instigated the failed slave insurrection at Harper's Ferry in 1859 as he was being sentenced and executed. She fought for women's suffrage and founded the National Association of Colored Women. She was a poet and a novelist and was considered the mother of African American journalism. One of her poems was the reading just before the sermon. Her entire life personified what love looks like in public. The end of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery did not end the oppression or the legacy of slavery. It simply took new forms. The entangled forms of violence would continue with the creation of segregation, Jim Crow laws, lynching, poll taxes, among other things. Later in her essay, The Idea of America, Nicole Hannah Jones writes about Isaac Woodard, an African-American who served during World War II. After serving for 4 years, he was honorably discharged in 1946 and was riding home on a bus to South Carolina. At a rest stop, he had a brief altercation with the bus driver after asking to use the restroom. The bus drove down the road a bit, and then the bus driver told Woodard he would have to get off. Waiting outside the bus was a group of police who beat Woodard so badly that he remained blind for the rest of his life. She wrote, "Many white Americans saw black men in uniforms of America's armed services not as patriotic, but as exhibiting a dangerous pride. Hundreds of black veterans were beaten, maimed, shot, and lynched." It was this paradox post-World War II that the United States had gone overseas to fight for freedom, but still could not practice this freedom when it came to the lives of many African Americans in this country. That galvanized the civil rights movement of the 1950s and the 1960s. Our walking tour ended at the center of Boston Common, where we try and fill in the history of the mid to late 20th century. As we ended our tour, we still had 2 pages of script left, and we tour guides had to decide which history we would share. So some of us shared the history of James Reeb, who with 200-plus Unitarian Universalist ministers and seminarians heeded the call to join Martin Luther King Jr. for his march on Selma and Montgomery. James Reeb, a Unitarian minister, was murdered during his stay in Alabama by a group of men who didn't like the fact that all these white ministers were working with their black counterparts towards civil rights. The African-American UU historian Mike Morrison Reed writes in his book, The Selma Awakening, "Genuine integration happens when parts form a whole. For this group of Unitarian Universalists, Selma was memorable because they experienced what it felt like to be whole. The barriers of race and class, head and heart, were breached. Selma was about being in authentic relationship to one's values, promises, hopes, and honoring them by committing oneself even unto death. It was being in authentic relationship to African Americans and to one's own intelligence, emotions, spirit, and body in the midst of turmoil. Their values and their lives became congruent. They learned from their African American teachers who led the movement about struggle and love of community. But their radicalization, because of their experiences in the South, often did not translate when they went back to their mostly white congregations. Many of their congregations rejected them, saw them as being too radical, wanting to move too fast towards civil rights. Many of their fellow ministers saw them as siding with those who were sowing seeds of disunity, anger, and violence. The legacy of slavery is still with us today. The criminalization of young black men who have not committed any crimes, the mass incarceration of disproportionately black and brown bodies, the disparities of wealth that were brought about by historically unfair lending practices and neighborhood redlining. All these things are the legacy of that fateful day 400 years ago when the first African slaves set foot in Virginia. It is a history of incredible violence and cruelty, but it is also the story of incredible resilience and perseverance, of believing that this country could live up to its most valiant and compassionate ideals. There was this notion post-Reconstruction and into the earliest 20th century that there was this Negro problem that had to be solved. At the end of her essay in the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah Jones turns this around. She asks the question, what if America understood finally in this 400th year that black Americans have never been the problem? They have been the solution. She writes, "We were once told by virtue of our bondage that we could never be American. But it was by our bondage that we became the most American of all. It makes a difference who frames and interprets history. Espousing and working for the ideals of justice and liberty for all, that's what love looks like in public. I have this sticker on my computer. I picked it up at some UU event a while ago. It talks about a particular kind of love. Love that calls you to show up. Love that grabs you and won't let you go until your whole life is dedicated to siding with that love. Love that makes justice. Love that changes the world. Love is hard. Do it anyway. Amen. And blessed be.